Our next speaker is Philip Whitefield from the Missouri University of Science and Technology, Environmental Impact. Phil?
So we are being educated today about how to make fuels. We're also being educated today about what we're doing within the University of Missouri system to monitor how those fuels might be applied. And I'm going to talk to you this afternoon about a specific application of monitoring techniques that allow us to assess the viability of alternative aviation fuels from an environmental perspective. The work that I'm going to talk to you about today is sponsored at Missouri S&T through our membership in an FAA-sponsored Center of Excellence for Aerospace Emissions Research. And you can see we're part of a 9-university consortium that focuses on research related to aviation interests in both noise and emissions. If you've been watching the news, certainly in the last year, you'll be aware that a number of airlines have sponsored research and activities associated with actually flying aircraft with alternative fuel sources to the conventional oil-based fuels that are currently used by the commercial fleets throughout the world. You can go to the web and pick up YouTube output from Continental Airlines, from Virgin Atlantic, and from New Zealand, just to name a few here. And what I'll be talking to you about when we get beyond the purposes for needing to look at alternative aviation fuels, to tell you some results from work we did jointly with General Electric and Boeing to prepare for the Virgin Atlantic flight that occurred back in February of last year. So just a little bit of a primer for those of you that aren't too smart on emission-related issues with respect to environmental impact. When we operate an aircraft burning conventional fuels, the major products of combustion are carbon dioxide and water, but there are a whole bunch of other species that are being generated, and some of those have concern from an environmental perspective. That concern may be related to climate change. We've heard about greenhouse gases and so on. And the very fact that our aircraft commercial fleets operate in a very narrow region of the atmosphere where they can have a significant impact with the pollutants that are released from the combustion process with conventional fuels. And then the same processes as well will also drive issues related to local air quality issues around airports. So the environmental health, environmental impacts with respect to health at airports and our impact on climate are driven by needing to know and understand the nature of the emissions. If we know a fair bit about the nature of the emissions from conventional fuels, we need to know also what we're going to do if we use an alternative fuel. It would be unwise, surely, to replace a conventional fuel. The devils in the emissions, maybe we know and understand, with another that hasn't been evaluated from that perspective when we have the capability to do that. And I'll show you what we have at Missouri S&T in our center to be able to look at these things. The other big driver for alternative fuels is actually the economy, not only energy security, but the fact that we're past that peak. You saw the presentation maybe this morning from the person from the Danforth Center in terms of oil production, or we're certainly close to it. And we had, up until recently, ever-rising fuel prices. And I guess we can all imagine that they're going to go back there in the future. And those oil prices also impact the economy of our commercial fleets. So if we're looking for a replacement fuel, what are some of the things that the aviation industry is particularly interested in? Well, you can compare, for example, a fuel in terms of its energy density with respect to mass and its energy density with respect to volume. And you'll notice that jet fuel turns out to be about as good as it gets in terms of fuel candidates that we're aware of today. It's to the extreme right-hand side of that chart, okay? Decreasing tank volume, okay, and aircraft drag, decreasing aircraft weight are both attractive features. And there, also on that plot, you see a number of other fuel candidates. Taking conventional fuel and removing the sulfur almost completely. The previous speaker talked about the levels of sulfur content. And that's right. Typically, any aircraft operating today has probably got an average of between 700 and 900 parts per million of sulfur in the fuel. You can go to new fuel formulation types, and you can also go to other sources, such as fuels based on ethanols and biodiesel. You can't reach the optimum condition you have with current JP8, Jet A, with those, but you can come close. And so they're attractive alternatives to look at. So the objectives in the research program that we're conducting and sponsored by the FAA is to look at reducing emissions, okay, from a global climate and an air quality perspective, okay, and expand the diversity of energy sources that are there. Those are the objectives, but there are constraints, okay? We have to focus on fuels that are compatible with our existing infrastructure. The industry talks about the fuel in the near term, and certainly I think within the next decade, needs to be a fuel that we would call a drop-in fuel. That means it's one that can go into our existing infrastructure and be indistinguishable from any other fuel source that we allow to operate there. So the fuel's got to be like Jet A or JP8 in terms of its compatibility with respect to transportation and infrastructure and application in the various engines that it's going to be used in. Okay, and yet at the same time, it's got to be able to be produced economically, and it's got to be environmentally compatible. So those are the constraints that we're applying. No two fuels are going to have the same properties. Each fuel is going to be different. Each fuel is going to have a different set of constraints associated with it in its application. We're going to look particularly at the emissions in the work that I'm describing here. So back in preparation for that flight for Virgin Atlantic in February of last year, in the late November, December of 2007, we worked with Boeing and GE at GE's engine test facilities in central Ohio to burn candidate alternative fuels, one including the one that would be used by Virgin. And at the same time as engine performance information was being acquired, so emissions information was being acquired at the same time. Just to give those of you an idea of the fuels that were tested in this study, the baseline fuel was Jet A and Jet A1, which is the Jet A equivalent that's used basically in Europe. And then there were blends and an example of a pure Fischer-Tropsch fuel as well. So the biofuel was a fatty acid methyl ester. It's not probably the optimum candidate for a biofuel for aviation, but it was certainly the one that was available, and that was the one that was being used in the quantities that were going to be needed for the flight demonstration. On that slide, I've got a note there that says that no near-field plume data was acquired. We measure emissions at the exit plane of the exhaust nozzle, and thereby we can determine what's really coming out of the engine and is generated by the engine. But as that plume evolves and mixes with the ambient atmosphere, so its properties change with respect to the pollutants and particularly the particulate matter in that pollutant, which my group is interested in. In order to get near-field plume data, we must sample downstream, and there wasn't an opportunity to do that. I'll tell you at the end of the talk about a very recent campaign where we've gone out to get that information. That information is also critical when we come down to issues with respect to local air quality. Again, coming back to the point that no two fuels are the same, I draw your attention to the fuel properties here. It's a complex chart, but you'll notice that each of those mixtures has essentially different heat of combustion, okay? If we're going to compare apples to apples, by comparing the nature of the emissions from a candidate alternative fuel to that of a baseline fuel, then we need to adjust for the fact that the available energy in the fuel is different so that we can make that correction and comparison. Okay, and then there's a footnote on there, as I mentioned before, that the ester fuels are really not considered as a viable alternative aviation fuel, but it was the fuel that was available in the quantity necessary for that demonstration. That changes. If we're going to make comparisons, we need to make sure that at least the emissions that we are recording are representative of the engine type that we're using. The engine type that we studied was the CFM56 engine. It's generated by a consortium mainly represented by GE and Snecma in Europe. And that engine is basically the power source for about 70% of the domestic fleet. You're flying on a 737 somewhere in the United States anytime in the near future. More likely, the engines are going to be CFM56s of a certain type. So what you see on this plot is here's some conventional combustion gas products. Okay, and what you're seeing is information for various fuel types and the blends, and then you'll see there's black data there that's listed as APEX. That was a major study conducted 2 or 3 years ago using conventional fuels on this engine itself, okay, that was studied here. And what we're seeing is that for the various blends and fuels that we're using, that with respect to the combustion gases, generally speaking, we've got similar performance, okay? That tells us then that this engine is operating in a representative manner when we go to look at things like soot production, which is not a certified emission characteristic for a commercial jet engine. You might notice in the NOx and the NO2 data there that the NO2 generated by the blends and all is significantly less here. What's driving that actually is that available energy in the fuel issue that I showed you earlier. So from a gaseous emissions performance perspective, there are no surprises here. There's no real differences. The engine's going to operate on this fuel pretty well, and we're not really changing things like CO or NOx, particularly here. However, when we look at speciated hydrocarbons, and that's another talk, then we start to see that those things change. And that's because the formulation of the fuels that we're looking at are very different in terms of their complex mixture to that of the conventional jet fuel. Particulate emissions are also representative. The two different colors there represent this test and the test that was done previously. And what we're looking at is a particle parameter, the geometric mean diameter, the average size of the particles that are coming out of the engine as a function of the operating condition. But here's some data where we're looking at comparing the emissions of Jet A1 and 100% Fischer-Tropsch fuel, okay, that was studied in this case. Both plots have the same axes. You're plotting differential concentration versus particle size. And I think you can see that in the lower plot, where you're looking at the emissions from the 100% FT fuel, there's a significant reduction there. So this is the basic information that's being acquired in these studies with respect to particulate matter, information about what's happening to the size and number and mass of the particles. Now, that's pretty complicated. All the data is dumped on there for all of the different fuels. But generally, I would draw your attention to the bottom two plots, where we're looking at the change in two important parameters. The change in the number-based emission index is a function of the fuel, and the change in the mass-based emission index. And for those of you who are not familiar with that term, emission index is the mass of emittent per kilogram of fuel burned, or the number of particles per kilogram of fuel burned. You can see some significant trends there, particularly in the case of what's happening with respect to the number-based emission index. There's another subtle issue that came out of this study. I'm not going to spend a lot of time to point out, but these experiments are complex and expensive to conduct. And you'll notice that we wanted to need to keep everything constant except, say, the thing we're changing, which might be the fuel. But you'll notice on the day when we were getting the baseline data for the Jet A1, the ambient temperature there in central Ohio was 10 degrees warmer on that day. That's a concern because there's going to be an issue with respect to the change in the temperature on the nature of the emissions that's going to convolute the data analysis. We were able to use a couple of approaches to address that. I won't go into that detail. But generally speaking, if we look in terms of data on the right-hand side with the ester fuel and on the right-hand side with a blend in the 100% FT, when we apply that correction for that temperature change, we can see some definite trends with respect to the number-based emission index. And those are summarized here. There's a statistically significant reduction in both the number and the mass-based emission index, with an average of between 50 to 60% in number reduction in the case of all of those fuels. These impacts were found most significantly at low engine operating conditions, when the engine is operating in its least efficient cycle, when an awful lot of those pollutants being generated. This is also the operating mode at airports. An aircraft is going to spend at most airports a lot longer time in taxi and idle than it is in actual takeoff. And so I think that's an important observation here. And that's the major message you need to take away from that study. I wanted to mention about a study that just has taken place in January in Palmdale, California, where we took NASA's DC-8 aircraft, also equipped with CFM56 engines. And in this case, what we were able to do was not only make measurements at the engine exit plane, but it also 30 meters downstream and 145 meters downstream in order to look at plume evolution and changes, because it's that kind of emission characteristic that's more important with respect to local air quality issues. You can actually, that program is sponsored by NASA. You can go and Google AFEX and find an awful lot of information about that program. But this slide, which will be my last one, is an opportunity to give you a taste for the kind of data that's being gathered. What you see are plots. They're plots of time on the horizontal axis, particle diameter on the vertical axis, and then the color represents the concentration of particles. Okay, so that the white end here is the highest concentration, the blue end is the lowest concentration. And what you see here is a set of measurements that occurred where we were on the right-hand engine at the exit plane looking at a Fischer-Tropsch fuel blend. We then moved to the 30-meter location, went to the left-hand engine where we were continuously burning the baseline fuel, JP8 in this case. Then moving to the right-hand engine and getting the 30-meter data on the F2 blend. And then at 145 meters, when we've now got a greatly dissipated plume, and looking at the nature of emissions down there. And the heavy green area there is a section of data that's gathered where we drive off all of the volatile component in the exhaust plume that's generated in gas-to-particle conversion as the plume propagates from the aircraft to the source. And what you see is that there's an awful lot of that going on in the expanding plume. And the nature of the emission changes radically. So a little bit later this year, this stuff will all be reported, and there'll be a lot of feedback in terms of our understanding with respect to particulate emissions, hydrocarbon speciation for these near-term candidate alternative aviation fuels. Thank you.